Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mohler is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. To get online with Dr. Mohler, call toll-free nationwide, 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mohler Program. Today, looking at one day in history, in this case, February 12, 2009, we're looking at the 200th anniversary, the birth of two men, Charles Darwin and Abraham Lincoln. Both of those men, indispensable to telling the story of the last 200 years, both of them born on one day in two different nations on the same day 200 years ago today. We're going to be talking today not so much about Lincoln, but about Darwin. Because in terms of the Christian worldview, it is Darwin that presents the greatest challenge. And Darwin has, ever since the publication of The Origin of Species 150 years ago this year, presented the Christian faith with a monumental challenge. And we're going to be talking about it today. We're going to be taking the measure of Charles Darwin, Darwinism, and the challenge of evolution 200 years after the birth of Charles Darwin. We're going to have a lot to talk about, and I'd like for you to join the conversation. You can do so by calling me at 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. And you can also go to Twitter.com just to follow us at Mohler Radio. We're going to have a conversation line that's already there. The thread is up. And we're going to be looking also at Facebook. Just go to the page for the Albert Mohler Program. And always our mail at mail@albertmohler.com. First, to review some other issues in the news, I find this absolutely fascinating. The Times of London. Here's a headline. Now, just consider that this is a headline. Big news. Quote, Anglicans called on to convert non-Christian believers, end quote. Fascinating headline. Every once in a while, the appearance of a headline comes along, and you know that the story is not so much what is there, but that it had to be said. And that's the case. This should not be big news that Anglican Christians are called upon to convert non-Christian believers, but it is news, and the fact that it is news, well, that's itself newsworthy. Ruth Gledhill, who is the very, very current and insightful religion correspondent for The Times, writes, Anglicans were commanded to go forth and evangelize yesterday, and a dramatic assertion of missionary fervor that could jeopardize carefully built-up relations with Muslim Jews and other faiths. She goes on to write, the church's general synod meeting in London overwhelmingly backed a motion to force its bishops to report on their, quote, understanding of the uniqueness of Christ in Britain's multi-faith society and offer guidance in sharing the gospel of salvation with people of other faiths and none. I want to know a lot more about this. I have to tell you, this is really piqued my curiosity. I want to know a lot about this. Well, for no other reason, perhaps, than just the second paragraph in Ruth Gledhill's story. She writes, the established Church of England put decades of liberal-inspired political correctness behind it in a move that led one bishop to condemn in anger the, quote, evangelistic rants, end quote. I mean no condescension in this, honestly, but I have never heard an evangelistic rant from an Anglican. I just can't imagine, given the culture of Anglicanism, that these words actually fit. But I am thankful, nonetheless, that there is some concern for sharing the gospel. You would think that, given the centrality of the Great Commission in Christ's assignment to his disciples, that there would be no question about this. But obviously, there is. You've got a lot going on here. The Reverend Neslin Sterling, who is a minister in the New Testament Assembly, I'm not sure all that is other than it appears to be an overseas representation of Anglicanism, said the marginalization of Christianity was proceeding at a rapid rate with further examples reported every day. Went on to say, we have positioned ourselves like the disciples did immediately after the death of Christ behind closed doors, paralyzed with fear of the world. Those are strong words. According to this report, the move was proposed by a Paul Eddy, who is a lay member from the Winchester Diocese, who said he was aware of the religious and cultural tensions in many parishes in England. He also understood, quote, the distress that talk of the historic Crusades can evoke. Now, that's just bizarre. Just from any historical perspective, that's bizarre. When you talk about evangelism, people start talking about the Crusades. The Crusades were not about evangelism. I mean, anyone who can read even the slightest introductory, most superficial treatment of the Crusades know that the Great Commission was not what was behind the Crusades. Territory was. hope of temporal glory. Certainly that was very much at stake. The idea of conquering and reclaiming territory and gaining riches, yes, that was very much at it. Even pushing back against Islam, yes, that was a part of the Crusades. But bearing evangelistic witness to the gospel of Christ, you're not going to find much of that in the Crusades. This is really, really interesting. You know, there is a real sense that conversion is the big issue here. That comes out in this article. The Reverend Andrew Dow, vicar in Cheltenham, said, "The dreaded C word, we are terrified by it, but why? We need to recover our nerve." I love this next sentence. "We need to refute the lie that to be evangelistic is to be a religious bigot or fundamentalist fanatic," end quote. Okay, here's a little piece of unsolicited advice for the Reverend Andrew Dow. The kind of people who would consider that anyone calling for one to convert to his own belief, that would witness to one saying that he should convert to the witnesser's belief, the kind of person who would consider that that is to be a religious bigot or fundamentalist fanatic is always going to believe that that's what it means to be a religious bigot or fundamentalist fanatic. And perhaps because they do understand what is at stake. It's not exchanging one brand of margarine for another. It's not just, changing allegiance to one auto manufacturer to another. It's not leaving one club to join another. It's not just even leaving one nationality to identify with another. It is leaving one belief system to accept one that is radically different. And if the gospel of Jesus Christ means anything, it means a belief system that is radically different than every other belief system. You can't underestimate what conversion really means. We'll be watching this one with great interest. In the state of Washington, back on November the 4th of 2008, voters voted to approve an assisted suicide mechanism. Now there are regulations being handed down. The regulations include a form. You're going to love this. It's called a request for medication to end my life in a humane and dignified manner, end quote. You know, euphemism is such a horrible thing. When you dress up something in language that really clouds and disguises what it is, this is a form to request medication to commit suicide. That's what it is, to end one's life by one's own action. But instead, the form is called, I'm going to read it to you again, Request for Medication to End My Life in a Humane and Dignified Manner. This form is going to be used as proposed by terminally ill Washington residents in order to begin the process that would lead to their deaths. The form also states, you're going to love this, quote, "I understand the full import of this request and I expect to die when I take the medication to be prescribed. I further understand that although most deaths occur within 3 hours, my death may take longer, and my physician has counseled me about this possibility." Very interesting. You know, when you have something as minuscule as having to go have a doctor treat, I don't know, a hangnail, you're going to have to sign a release for treatment. If you have something of even minor surgical interest and of significance, if you're going to have a child to have tubes put in her ears, or if you're going to go in to have a minor surgical procedure, you're going to have to sign away page after page of, I understand that this is what's going to happen. I understand that these are the risks. I understand that this might happen. I understand. And I still want the treatment. And these are all legal waivers to at least create some barrier to the medical personnel and the medical facility being sued. Well, what about when you want medication to kill yourself? You know, what kind of waiver would be necessary for this? Now you see some of the wording. The wording, I understand the full import of this request. Now, who could really understand the full import of this request? That's huge. And I expect to die when I take the medication to be prescribed. Well, let's just remember that the entire title of the form is Request for Medication to End My Life in a Humane and Dignified Manner. I further understand, says the form, that although most deaths occur within 3 hours, my death may take longer. My physician has counseled me about this possibility. According to the Seattle Post-Intelligencer, those who make themselves candidates for this assisted suicide must voluntarily ask for the drug and self-administer it. There's also going to be something on the form to show that the patient is acting voluntarily, but some groups want more. They want the form to require the patient to state that they've not been coerced, influenced, or pressured in any way through the process. That reminds me, one time I was pulled over by a law enforcement officer because they were looking for an escaped criminal. And even as I got out of my car and they looked at my car, they said, "Did you see anyone along the way?" I said, "No." The police officer then said, "Did you see anyone who told you to say no if you were asked if you saw anyone?" I said, "No." Well, just imagine that kind of question. Were you coerced in any way? Did anyone tell you to say you were not coerced? This is the language of the culture of death. And we'll be right back.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mohler Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. This is the 200th anniversary of the birth of Charles Darwin, of Abraham Lincoln also. But our topic today is Charles Darwin, because it's Darwin who presents by his theory of evolution, in particular natural selection, such a challenge to the Christian worldview. Now, the basic question for us is this: can evolution and Christianity be compatible? Can we consistently affirm evolution and Christianity? My answer to that is no, but I am very open to conversation to see how just it might be done. The phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. We're also going to be watching our thread on Twitter and at Facebook.com. At Twitter, it's Mohler Radio. Facebook.com, it's the Albert Mohler Program. Of course, you can write us at mail@albertmohler.com. We're going to go to Tim, calling from Minneapolis, Minnesota. Go ahead, Tim.
Yes, Dr. Mohler. Isn't it true Darwin discredited his own theory at the end of his life?
You mean by discredited what, Tim? Help me to understand that.
Well, I believe I read in the Evidence Bible that he decided that his theory was wrong at the end of his life and that didn't really get any publicity.
Yeah, you know, I'll just tell you, Tim, as best I can understand, that is really not a fair representation of Charles Darwin. As a matter of fact, as Charles Darwin grew older, he appeared to forfeit more and more of his Christianity and to go even into greater depth into understanding the significance of the evolutionary worldview. Now, there have been all kinds of tales told about Charles Darwin, such as at the end of his life, he repudiated evolution. I honestly don't believe there's any truth to that. There is no primary data that would help us to substantiate that. There are also those who suggest that he reclaimed his Christian faith. After all, he begun his adult life training for the ministry, the Anglican ministry. But there is also absolutely no primary source evidence that I can get a hold of for that. The people who knew him best seem to affirm the fact that he died an ardent agnostic. By the way, the word agnostic was new in the generation of Charles Darwin. It emerged by Thomas Huxley, his associate, who coined the word agnostic. Tim, I really do appreciate your call because it's helpful to say if anyone can ever produce primary documentation that either Darwin repudiated his theory or reclaimed his Christianity, that'd be very helpful. But I can just tell you that I have ransacked the literature, and I can find no good evidence of that. Tim, thanks so much for your call. And again, if you see some good evidence, please pass it along to me. Now, no doubt Darwin did tweak his theory. And as a matter of fact, there's some good material out now from Charles Darwin's diaries indicating that his own theory of evolution was evolving. You know, one of the interesting things about Charles Darwin and evolution is that almost everyone holds to a certain myth. And that myth is that Charles Darwin just came to the conclusion that evolution was true and real by a visit to the Pacific, in particular the Galapagos Islands, where looking at the diversity of flora and fauna, especially the animals, he came to the conclusion that the species were in an evolutionary pattern and that natural selection was the mechanism of that pattern. That is not true. Charles Darwin was an evolutionist before he ever went to the Galapagos Islands. Not only that, but Charles Darwin was descended from evolutionists. Evolutionary theory was already much discussed, an alternative to the biblical understanding of creation. that took into account what they saw as a fossil record and all the rest. This was already very much a part of the intellectual currents of his day. Charles Darwin did not go to the Galapagos Islands with a blank slate of a mind, just willing and waiting to see what he might see. He went there already committed to evolutionary theory and looking for what he would see as a plausible argument of how it worked. The big question for me is whether there is a compatibility between Christianity and evolutionary theory. My argument is this. If you understand Christianity, or even if you just understand theism, the belief in a personal, sovereign, creator God, and you believe, and you also understand that is evolutionary theory in its dominant academic form, I find it impossible to reconcile the two. And thus, as a Christian theologian, I see Darwinian theory, the entire category of evolutionary theory, as one of the great and most toxic challenges in terms of the worldview conflict of our day. I'd love to hear from you. The phone number is 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. I was really glad to hear from Tim in Minneapolis. I have to tell you something. That this is new. This tells you something about this new age of social media. Tim called, and he was calling off of the Twitter feed. And, underneath the name on the management software I'm looking at for radio, I have the caller's name in the city and then where they're listening. And under Tim's name, it says Twit, which I thought at first was a rude thing to say about a caller. But now I understand that we have four characters, and TWIT is short for Twitter. You can follow us on Twitter by going to twitter.com, and we're glad to hear from you there. And again, I'm glad to hear from you, and I'm especially glad to hear from you when, for instance, we have a conversation like the one I just had with Tim, and you say, here's something I think you need to look at. You help me when you send me material. It might be a website, a link. It might be an article where you say, hey, I think you need to read this. It might be a recommendation about a book. Hey, I want to see everything you think I need to see. And you will help me by pointing me in that direction. All right, the phone number is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. Let's go to Jerry, listening on the World Wide Web, calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Go ahead, Jerry.
Hello, Dr. Mohler. I believe in evolution. I don't believe in God. I'm an atheist. But I'm willing to look at the evidence for, say, theism and Christianity. And if it was sufficient to show that a God or even the Christian God exists, I would have to be open-minded to accept it. I would ask no more people who aren't, who don't believe in evolution, to fall where the evidence for evolution is. I mean, I think a God would want us to follow the evidence, and sufficient evidence shows a case for something such as evolution. Then you have to seriously look at the evidence and see if it's true.
Okay, Jerry, thanks. Hang on. Don't hang up. Thanks for your call, first of all. And I appreciate and respect what you're calling for in terms of intellectual credibility here. And that's going to work two ways in this conversation. I want to ask you a question, and that is, when you say you're willing to consider the evidence for theism, I want to ask, what kind of evidence would you consider would be sufficient? And then you have every right to turn to me and say, all right, look at all these fossils. How do you explain that? And that affords me the first responsibility to say that I reject evolutionary theory in its dominant form as explaining the origin of all things. But, no conservative Christian should deny that there's a process of change that is evident within the animal kingdom, and that there's even a process of some natural selection that appears at least to be natural. When we look, for instance, all you have to do is look at a herd of cattle and understand that there is adaptation and that there is indeed a competition of genes that is visible. But when it comes to the creation of human beings, and in particular when it comes to the question as to the originating mechanism of creation, that's where theism runs right into collision with where modern evolutionary theory is, also Charles Darwin. Now, I believe that the most accurate, the most detailed in terms of meaning account of creation is that which is offered in the Bible. Now, there is so much there, and I'm accountable to believe every word of it, but the Bible doesn't explain everything about every mechanism God used in order to bring the world into being, but it does give us many non-negotiables about what that creation is, who was behind it, for what purpose it was created, and especially when it gets to human beings, there you have a direct conflict with evolutionary theory. I'll be right back.
listening to the Albert Mohler Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. To get online, call toll-free 1-877-893-TALK. That's 1-877-893-8255. Or go to www.albertmohler.com. Here again is your host, Dr. Albert Mohler.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. We're talking about Darwinism, more generally, evolutionary theory, and whether or not it can be reconciled with biblical Christianity. We're talking about it on the Albert Mohler Program today on the 200th anniversary of the birth of Charles Darwin. I would consider Charles Darwin to be one of the intellectual horsemen of the 20th century. I think you could just put him together with Nietzsche, Freud, and Marx, and you have the four horsemen of the modern mind. And all four of them present radical challenges to biblical Christianity. Karl Marx, Friedrich Nietzsche, Sigmund Freud, Charles Darwin, every one of them provided a worldview and contributed to the development of the modern mind in a way that presents a direct challenge to biblical Christianity. Now, I believe that the world was created by a sovereign, omnipotent creator God exactly, precisely as it is set forth in the Genesis narrative. I also believe that indispensable to our understanding of that is that God was not merely fashioning the creation out of what was already pre-existent, nor was he merely working with a process in order to guide it in some generalized way, nor was he waiting to see how this would turn out, but rather, exactly as Genesis indicates, he was creating the world in order that the world would be the theater of his glory for the demonstration of the gospel of Christ, and he created human beings as the only being made in his image as his covenant partner. You know, what we're looking at here is where Christianity runs directly into collision with Darwinism. Now, there are those who will style themselves as theistic evolutionists. They'll say there is a way to reconcile evolution and theism, or belief in a personal sovereign God. Now, there are a couple of ways that there are folks who tried to approach that. For instance, one who was not a theistic evolutionist but tried to create ground for it was the late Stephen Jay Gould, paleontologist at Harvard University. His idea was that there were what he called non-overlapping magisteria. You got to understand that. It's a very sophisticated term, but it makes a lot of sense. It just fails as a theory. And here's his theory. You have the magisterium of science, that is to say, the authority of modern science, and then you have the authority of theology, and he says they don't overlap because they don't ask the same questions. Therefore, they can't be in conflict because they're not talking about the same thing. Well, as both sides of that equation recognize, that's a ridiculous argument. When both are talking about the meaning of life, you bet this is an overlapping situation. You can't divide it that easily. Now, Jerry Coyne, writing in the New Republic just recently, and he comes from the more atheist, explicitly atheist scientific wing here, he writes in his review of two books that are published, you see the review published at the New Republic, he writes that there are basically just a couple of ways to try to make evolution and Christianity or theism reconciled. And he says one is that you simply include the one and the other, which is kind of like what you had with Stephen Jay Gould. And he says the easiest way to harmonize science and religion is simply to redefine one so that it includes the other. We may claim, for example, that God, he puts God in quotation marks, is simply the name we give to the order and harmony of the universe, the laws of physics and chemistry, the beauty of nature, and so on. Then he says, and this is absolutely right, he says, but the big problem with this reconciliation in which science does not marry religion so much as digest it is that it leaves God out completely, or at least the God of the monotheistic faiths who has an interest in the universe. And I love this next sentence. He says, and this is unacceptable to most religious people. Well, for good reason. He says this, a meaningful effort to reconcile science and faith must start by recognizing them as they actually understood, as they are actually understood and practiced by human beings. You cannot redefine science so that it includes the supernatural, nor can you take religion, and he's exactly right on this line. I want you to hear this. He says, nor can you take religion to be the philosophy of liberal theologians, which, frowning on a personal God, is often just a hair's breadth away from pantheism, or I would add, atheism. I think he's exactly right. Those who claim to reconcile Darwinism, in particular modern dominant evolutionary theory with theism have to redefine the one or the other to mean something other than what they mean. They are making irreconcilable claims. Daniel Dennett, one of the four horsemen of the new atheism, I remember years ago when I read that he described evolutionary theory as what he called the universal acid. It's the intellectual acid that burns through everything. And he thought quite clearly that it burned through theism. There's no way for theism to continue. It kind of reminds me of what Stephen Hawking has said. He said, God may exist, but by his scientific perspective, once you understand the scientific model, there's nothing left for God to do. That is not reconcilable with Christianity. We'll be right back.
The Superior Gold Group, a precious metals firm, is proud to sponsor the Albert Mohler Program. You can get more information about buying gold at 866-432-8656.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. We're talking about the significance of Darwinism, the 200th anniversary of the birth of Charles Darwin. Also, as we have noted, the 200th anniversary of the birth of Abraham Lincoln. Very different story, very different mark in history. For Charles Darwin, well, the name is absolutely now inseparable from evolutionary theory. You really can't talk about the one without the other. When Darwin was first promoting the theory, as a matter of fact, it was more commonly known as Darwinism. That's why that term continues to this day. The earliest response to Darwin's thought were directed directly at what they called Darwinism. Now, of course, it's more commonly called evolutionary theory or just evolution. Hot controversies. The big question is, of course, whether or not evolutionary theory can be reconciled with Christianity. And my argument is that it cannot, if you properly understand both Christianity, which requires full biblical theism, and on the other hand, evolutionary theory. And there are people who are saying, well, why not? Why couldn't God merely have used the process of evolution to lead to where he wanted to go in creation? Well, let's talk about that for just a moment. First of all, we have to wonder if that's what evolutionary theory is actually suggesting. The closer you look at the dominant model, when I call that dominant model, it's because anyone can label his or her own theory evolution. But what is taught as evolution in America's colleges and universities and is put forth by scientists, whether it be Richard Dawkins or the late Carl Sagan or, Jerry Coyne, whom I have cited on this program just a few moments ago, what they're presenting is an understanding of evolution that suggests that natural selection is indeed the mechanism and that it is entirely natural and in no case supernatural. So there is no way for God to intervene in the process and it remain natural. So those who hold the dominant theory of evolution literally have no place for God to enter the picture. And specifically, and Jerry Coyne, for instance, understands this, where most Christians who try to reconcile evolution with Christianity want to bring God in is especially with the creation of human beings and suggest that there you have a very special act, a supernatural act. But that is expressly what the dominant theorists of evolutionary theory will not accept. They say that's absolutely incompatible. Then their evolution is no longer driven by natural selection. Now there is a supernatural selection. So then you have some others who try to come up with the idea that what God did in the beginning was wind up a process. In other words, to kind of create a cocktail and wind up a process so that the world had to end up by what appears to be natural selection just as he wanted it. Well, the problem with that is, once again, you really don't have natural selection. What you have is a predetermined plan from a creator that is simply the outworking of what had to happen. And that's what's really, really important here, because the theory of evolution holds that these things didn't have to happen this way. If they had to happen this way, then again, it wasn't natural selection. What if the fish had been in slightly warmer water? What if this amoeba had gone in this direction? If it had to turn out this way, evolutionists say evolution just falls. Now, one of the things that drives evolutionists nuts in this country, and those who are really concerned about this, is the fact that most Americans still don't believe in evolution. So here is a Gallup report out yesterday, the day before Darwin's 200th birthday. It says that indeed only 4 out of 10 Americans believe in evolution. Only 4 out of 10, that's 40%. Now, I remember seeing just recently 37%, so that seems to be a very consistent range for the figure here. I remember, for instance, you've got Nicholas Kristof, a very, very influential columnist for the New York Times years ago, writing that he didn't want to live in a nation where more people believed in the virgin birth than in evolution. But as any poll will show, that's this nation. Sorry, Mr. Kristof. The big question is, why do people not believe in evolution? That's driving the evolutionists crazy. And the reason why I believe they do not believe in evolution is because when they look in the mirror, they cannot see an accident. And, of course, now you've got those who try to explain, well, what you have is the appearance of design, and that appearance of design is actually deceptive. I wrote about on my website at albertmiller.com and talked about on this program sometime back an argument being made that children, for instance, are made to imply and infer design where it doesn't exist. Therefore, children are likely to be creationists because they just can't imagine that all this happened by some kind of natural process. They know that mommy and daddy make this and people make that, and they can't believe the world is just an accident. And, of course, what they suggest is we need to get over that infantilism, that childlike understanding, but it doesn't happen. Here, the Princeton Research Organization, located in Princeton, New Jersey, the Gallup organization, is saying that only 39% of Americans say they believe in the theory of evolution. A quarter say they do not believe in the theory. Another 36% don't have an opinion either way. And of those who attend church regularly, only 24% say that they believe in evolution. Fascinating stuff there. Let me tell you what else is fascinating. When you start looking at how this argument is framed, and you have people debating whether or not evolutionary theory can be made compatible with Christianity, you just got to watch that the categories mean what the words suggest they should mean. I was in a conversation with someone just several weeks ago, and he declared himself to be a theistic evolutionist. I said, well, that's very interesting. I said, do you understand theism? He said, yes. I said, what is theism? He said, it's belief in a personal God. I said, bingo, that's theism. It's belief in a personal, supernatural, infinite, sovereign God. Good. You understand theism. I said, what's evolution? He said, evolution is the understanding that all things that exist came into being by purely natural processes that are understandable if we just had enough evidence, for instance, in a fossil record and all the rest. And I said, well, what in the world? Hey, no, do you have two different hemispheres of your brain, one hemisphere being theism, the other being evolution? How in the world can you put those two together? And he said, because I want to. Now, that was an extremely revealing statement. You know, given the dominant intellectual pressure in this country, I understand the want to. But I must tell you honestly that the closer you look at theism and the closer you look at evolution, the more irreconcilable they become. And that's why I think it's helpful when you have an evolutionist, or not only that, an army of evolutionists who are ready to make the same case. You know, I'm convinced that looking years down the road, there will still be those who believe in divine creation, and there will still be those who believe in evolution. But I can't believe that this kind of mediating position of theistic evolution really has legs to move into the future. Because what's going to happen is that evolutionary theory is going to claim more and more terrain, leaving less and less for the theistic evolutionists to try to grab a hold of. Back with Final Thoughts in just a moment. I'm Albert Mohler. Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. You know, this conversation is one that we come to again and again because when you get to the explanation of the existence of the universe, of the cosmos, and in particular, the explanation for the existence and status of human beings, you're talking about what's most fundamental to our worldview. You're talking about what is non-negotiable to our understanding. You know, the big issue for us is always the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. For Christians, that's the touchstone. That's where we come back again and again. And that's where the biblical storyline becomes so very important when we try to understand what it means to say that God was in Christ reconciling. What are we talking about there? Was it that God was kind of working through an evolutionary process and perhaps even entering in here and there? The evolutionists say he couldn't have, but let's say he did. He just kind of dabbled in here and there. And then he cobbled together a system whereby he decided that having seen that human beings were sinful, he would try to do something in order to redeem them. You can put together a theology like that, but it is not what is presented in the Bible. The Bible presents a sovereign God who determined before the world was created to redeem a people through the blood of his Son, and who created all that is by the power of his word in order that he would make among all the things that he would create human beings as special beings, the ones who alone are made in his image. And he would make those creatures the only creatures capable of knowing him and of having the moral consciousness to obey and to disobey him. Then comes the entire biblical storyline that begins in creation and then moves to the fall and the reality of human sin and then to the redemption that is accomplished in Christ and then to the consummation of all things, in which we do not have merely a repair of creation, but the renewal that comes about in a new heaven and a new earth, the emergence in full display of the glory of God and his kingdom. You know, the problem is that if you try to incorporate evolutionary theory into that, it's not just that it is a problem at the beginning of that storyline. It's also a problem at the end. So, let's think about it more. I'm always glad to hear from you. Write me at mail@albertmoeller.com. Remember to sign up at twitter.com and follow Moeller Radio. You can always go to the website. You'll find an entire treasury of resources that are available free there for you. And let's continue the conversation. You can do so also at facebook.com at the Albert Moeller Program. Thanks for listening today. We'll continue this conversation. And, of course, remember today's not only the 200th anniversary of Charles Darwin, but also of Abraham Lincoln. It's also the birthday of the producer of this program, Matt Hall. I didn't know until today he shares that distinction with Darwin and Lincoln. Well, that's a day. Back tomorrow for Intelligent Christian Conversation. You're listening to the Albert Moeller Program.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Moeller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.